Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the noon hour, and we thank him for saying, Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Great to be with you.
A lot of crazy, weird things going on. Let's go to New York City, talk about this rent freeze that has passed and what we think the potential outcome or possible outcomes are going to be.
Yeah, we've discussed this before, and people were afraid that it would occur, and now it has, in fact, occurred. New York has an interesting group called the Rent Guideline Board, and the Rent Guideline Board sets the amount that rent can increase for 1 million units in New York. They're called rent-stabilized units. So 1 million units are subject to this. It's something that Mayor Mondami ran on, freeze the rent. And in fact, now the rents have been frozen effective October 1st. Now, the problem, and it's a challenging problem, it's hard to explain to tenants who just want to see their rent reduced, is banks lend money for people who want to acquire a rental property based on net operating income. So you look at rental income minus expenses, maintenance, taxes, utilities, and then that number has to cover debt service. Well, the challenge is when you freeze the rent, but insurance is going up, and insurance has gone up, utility costs have gone up, the cost of maintenance continues to go up because of the cost of labor and also supplies. So net operating income is declining, and that means you can borrow less money. So if you own a rent-controlled apartment, your value just went down. And that means whatever, you know, appreciation you thought you were going to experience, you didn't experience. But the bigger problem is now a lender looks at a new borrower and says, okay, today you might have enough income to service your debt, but a year from now, when costs go up and rent does not, you won't have enough margin. So we're going to reduce the amount we're going to lend so that even in the future, as rates go up and as costs go up and your rent doesn't go up, you can still afford it. So this makes it very difficult to refinance rent-controlled apartments and reduces the value. So if you bought this, you know, like many people do here in New Orleans, they'll buy a double, buy a fourplex, maintain it, and build some net worth. I mean, my wife and I did that when we were young. You're not going to be able to do that because these rent-controlled apartments are actually going to decline in value year by year. So you literally have an asset that, as long as this administration is in place in New York, is going to decline in value every year. So hard to get people excited about making an investment where you know for sure that the value of your investment is actually going to get smaller every year that you hold it.
And at the same time, this administration, the Mondani administration, has a desire to increase taxes in a bunch of different forms, right? So these same investors are faced with these additional taxes as a result of owning these rent control units. And so they get the double whammy.
They do. And New York struggles. They're very vulnerable to sea level rise and hurricanes. A lot of the subways, you know, significantly flood anytime there's a high water event. And New York has a lot of deferred maintenance. So the city is looking at ways to increase taxes in order to cover that and increase fees. So they have transaction fees, the user fees, and then the usual suspects, you know, raise the cigarette and alcohol taxes. But the city is limited by the state charter in what they can raise. So they have to negotiate with the state of New York. And it does make it difficult because the city has a budget deficit that is going to get worse next year. And to the extent that the other government policies drive some of the richer people out of New York, it's going to make it very challenging to balance the budget. And, you know, that's one more thing that will be difficult for small landlords and for the citizens of New York. And it's not something that people have focused on. And the unfortunate thing is the mayor is really feeling very politically powerful. He, you know, he backed three candidates, including two to unseat sitting Democratic office holders. So he's not making friends in the national party. And in one of the people he helped unseat was the head of the Hispanic caucus. So it's going to be challenging when New York needs money from the feds or needs money from the state, because he is beginning to do some things that are alienating the other people in the party and some things that just economically don't make sense. I mean, it's politically popular, and I certainly understand it for tenants. Look, freezing the rent is a great idea, but when you realize your landlord now can't afford to maintain the unit, doesn't want to, can't sell it because nobody wants to buy it because the price is now declining and it's a declining asset. So you're really setting up a shortage of housing. And in the long run, it's not going to be a productive policy. But in the short run, politically, it does look like a winner. And for him, it did work, particularly in these elections where his endorsed candidates won.
So how do you end up in this rent control sphere, or is it just it was imposed on you as an owner of rental units? How did that work?
Well, the unfortunate thing, this is a case where government has rules, and you and I actually have to, you know, work within the rules. You know, we have guidelines, we have regulations for banking. We have to comply with those regulations or we get in trouble. The Rent Guideline Board is supposed to look at the increase in cost. And then they're supposed to use that increase in cost to set the new rental. Well, what happened is Mondami appointed a majority of the members to this board. The board staff did research and said, look, for a one-year lease, you need to have about a 4% increase to cover the cost. For 2 years, about 6%. Those are what the numbers show. You know, that's not too much, not too little, but that covers the actual increase in cost. They ignored both of those numbers and said, we're just going to say zero. You know, freeze the rent was the campaign. And so it's a political decision, not an economic decision, and it's one that will have real consequences. The unfortunate thing is this goes all the way back to World War II, when a significant number of people moved to New York to work in the shipbuilding business and a lot of the other businesses. And rent control was instituted then just to keep existing landlords from gouging the new tenants. Well, there was rent control in a number of cities, but most of them got rid of it. New York never did. And now it's reaching the point of with zero, becoming a real challenge, because certainly these landlords are going to be in deep trouble if this persists for a number of years. And it's hard to imagine after 2 years that the mayor's going to want to eliminate rent control or go back on the zero pledge when he's up for reelection.
So every rental unit in New York City is impacted by this ruling?
No, there's an odd rule. It's has to be more than six units in the building and has to be built before 1974. Buildings after 1974 are subject to market rents. But the challenge and the fear that people have with newer units is the political pressure will build to enact some sort of rent control on the newer units. So, I mean, imagine if you were investing, you and your wife decide, okay, we're going to get some rental property. You could go anywhere in America. Well, if you buy it in New York, even if it's a post-74, with the political climate, you could easily get affected by a new law. So you'd be more likely to go to a city, you know, like Nashville that's booming, maybe not Austin, but somewhere in Florida. So, you know, I want to go somewhere where people are moving in and where you don't have a regulatory climate that is likely to reduce my income. But that's still a million units, so it's a big deal. And the other unfortunate thing is there are a number of units that landlords can't bring onto the market because the mandated repairs to bring them up to city standards can't be recovered in a timely manner. So you literally would spend more to rehab the unit and put it back in commerce than you could collect in rent. And so you're just not going to do it. And you have units sitting vacant while you have a tremendous demand for rental units. So it's a government policy that's absolutely counterproductive.
Yeah, I don't, this is, so what happens? I mean, what are the banks going to do when you have this freeze like this? And how long? Well, let me ask the question this way. Has there been a study to determine how many of these unit owners are at the risk of losing their property now?
There has not, but there was a bank with a significant concentration of loans on rent controlled called Signature Bank that actually failed. They had a number of delinquent loans, and that concentration of rent controlled apartments was one of the problems. So what a bank's going to do now? Normally you would look at a margin and say, okay, we need net operating income of 125% of the loan payment, because you figure, okay, next year rent can go up and that'll be all right. But if you know you're in New York City and next year the rent cannot go up, you're going to change your margin and say, look, we might need 150% of the loan payment as net operating income. So that reduces the loan amount. And if you think that the rent control is going to continue on, you're going to say, all right, let me project forward the increase in cost. Let me leave rental income stable. What loan can I make that you can afford to repay if the rent never goes up, but your costs do? And that'll significantly reduce the loan amount, and it'll significantly reduce the value of the properties. So what's happening is every bank in New York is recalibrating their lending, and on rent stabilized units, they're lending less than they would have a year ago. And it's interesting. You had a very progressive Mayor Adams before, who appointed members to the rent guideline board that actually followed the cost of, you know, maintaining and operating a unit. But you know, that didn't work out. And as I say, you have a new progressive mayor who ran on freezing the rent. So that's going to be a challenge for any lender and also any small apartment owner.
And then they complain and or wonder why the apartments are in disrepair, right?
Oh yeah, I mean,
and they're not up to standards.
Yeah, if you're a landlord, you have no incentive to do any maintenance. I mean, you do the absolute minimum to just keep from getting cited by the city. You know, repaint, forget that. We're not doing that. Re-carpet, not doing any of that. You know, update the appliances, why bother? You know, if they work, who cares? And if they quit working, you get used appliances that meet the minimum standard. So yeah, you push towards slum-like behavior. One of the interesting things is some of the progressives that are, and actually not progressives, progressives aren't liberal enough, the Democratic Socialists say that if this pushes into foreclosure and city ownership, that would be a good thing, because then they would have city-controlled apartments. But the problem is people haven't looked at the way the city of New York is operating the apartments they already have. The city is a terrible landlord. They have significant complaints from tenants. They don't maintain their units. They have real problems with roach rat infestation. Heat goes out, you know, regularly in the winter. So the city is actually awful as a landlord. But the objective for some of the Democratic Socialists is for the city to become an even bigger landlord.
Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be something that we'll watch and see how it unfolds for sure. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, we'll talk about the odd approach to high summertime temperatures in England and France and more when we return.
Drink up, baby. Fantasy Football Happy Hour is here to get you wins and have some laughs. Matthew Berry here, and my podcast, Fantasy Football Happy Hour, has the sleepers, busts, and starts and advice you need to win your league. We're diving into the tape, we're crunching the numbers to bring you sleepers, busts, weekly starts and advice. Whether you're defending a title or desperately avoiding last place, I've got you covered every single weekday. The bar is open. It's Fantasy Football Happy Hour with Matthew Berry, wherever you get your podcasts.
Stay with us. There's a heat wave making its way across Europe, and the responses have been very interesting. Guy, tell us about it.
Yeah. Temperatures are forecast in Paris to go from 91 up to a high of 96 in about 4 or 5 days. And so French cities, British cities are not really designed with temperatures like this in mind, and almost all of the apartments are unair-conditioned. So you can imagine being in an unair-conditioned apartment when the temperatures hit into the 90s. The French have a solution, which is they mix a chalk paste and then paint it on the windows. So you basically are covering the windows with a white chalk. Gives you a little bit of light inside and reflects a lot. The British are not doing the chalk paste because they want to be different. But what they're doing is really sort of trashy looking, which is tinfoil over the windows, blinds, of course. And what's intriguing is the governments are giving advice, and it's almost like they're talking to middle schoolers. You know, lower your blinds, keep the shades closed when the sun's directly on it. Sleep on the first floor. Take a cold bath before going to bed. When it does get cool outside, open the windows and let the cool air in. Keep the windows closed when it's cooler inside than out. It's like, I mean, really? These are not things that a normal adult would need to hear. So the idea is you're going to live in a bat cave, open the windows at midnight, and hopefully get a little cool air in. And unfortunately, particularly in the EU countries, it is very difficult to get air conditioning approved. It's almost like a moral imperative that you not use air conditioning. And so in London, you can't do window units without special approval, which is not granted except, you know, in extreme rare cases, maybe disabled elderly people. So you're stuck with no air conditioning, putting tinfoil on the windows, being advised to sleep downstairs, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, air conditioning actually works. The president of Singapore said it was the greatest invention of the century because it enabled that tropical country to be comfortable and to have people working during the hot summer days. So the advice people are getting is really straightforward and simple, but it doesn't really comfort anybody because you're trying to sleep in this kind of extreme heat, and the governments don't want you to do AC, and the rationale is climate change. And the unfortunate thing is the European Union is just not a significant contributor to global climate change. You know, they've been declining in their energy density. China is by far the biggest user of energy, you know, followed by the United States, India, and Indonesia. The United States is decreasing its energy usage, but India is ramping up. Indonesia is ramping up. Those are both very populous countries. So the unfortunate thing is the Europeans are forcing themselves to endure very miserable conditions for negligible results on the global climate scale. So you're not really affecting global climate by not having air conditioning. You're just making yourself extremely miserable. And so people are beginning to look at this and say, you know, politicians, y'all are just wrong. We need to reconsider air conditioning. It's not really a moral imperative that we have to be miserably hot, because even if we quit using any energy at all, it's not going to affect global temperatures.
Well, the solution is is very complex, though, right? Because they don't have the electrical grid infrastructure to support air conditioning more units, right?
Yeah, and it's the same problem that most countries develop is, you know, the electrical grid developed over time, and it was developed to meet specific needs and hasn't really been upgraded the way it should be. So even if you add solar power, you add wind power, you have to do an interconnected grid. Now, it's not undoable. You know, China's done it. A grid, we did it in the United States. We electrified. We did the rural electrification. You just have to decide you want to do it. And things we take for granted are not available. In London, the buses are un-air conditioned. Now, I know it's sort of neat to take the streetcar, and we don't expect them to be air conditioned, but, you know, if none of the buses are air conditioned, now you've got public transit being pretty unattractive. And so people are staying away from public transit and actually driving their cars more, which adds more to emissions, because the cars do have air conditioning. So it's one of those cases where government rules are making things very difficult for the citizens. And a lot of people are saying, you know, it's time for us to just air condition. You know, people travel to the U.S. They realize that, you know, we air condition, and yet emissions are declining in the United States.
Yeah. Let's pivot now. Let's talk about the Strait of Hormuz. This on again, off again. I mean, this is really getting crazy. Everything's up. Everything's down. The markets don't seem to know which way to go, meaning, you know, whether the spot market for oil and things of that nature.
Yeah, this is an intriguing ongoing challenge. BBC World News had an interesting comment, said it's almost like the kids in the neighborhood. They're having fights over the weekend, and then they go to school during the week. So, you know, we have tit for tat military exchanges. Iran launches a few drones. We launch a few counterattacks. Then we take a break. Ships go through. Then we do it again the following week. No one really knows where we are right now. The challenge is, each side has stated a position that the other side has said is unacceptable. The U.S. has said there has to be free motion in the strait, period. Iran has said we're going to control transit in the Strait of Hormuz, period. Well, both of those can't be true at the same time. Unless we do this weekend, you know, okay, during the week it's okay, during the weekend we're going to fight. So no one knows what the future is on this. The oil markets seem to be gambling that it's going to work out, because prices on oil have dropped dramatically. They were $65 a barrel before the Iran war. They're 70 now. They were a high of 112. So the oil markets are speculating that this will either settle to a low simmer or not go back to a crisis. A lot of oil has been shipped out. The Arab countries are building pipelines to bypass the strait. That, of course, will take time, but is something they're working on. The other thing is, you know, there's a saying that's an ill wind that bears no one any good. In this case, low oil prices actually hurt Russia. So Russia was loving the high oil prices during the war because it put a lot of income into the Russian treasury. Now that prices are back down, the Russian economy is really suffering, particularly as Ukraine develops longer range weapons. So as we see these prices come down, you still have continued instability. You're also seeing Russia being weakened. And for the first time, Vladimir Putin said this morning, he said, yeah, these are challenging times in Russia. And before that, he's never admitted that it had been a challenge. It's just a limited military operation. It'll be over soon. So we're seeing an effect on the global economy. We're going to have some permanent changes. One of the things that oil people will tell you is, if the strait fully reopened, with all of the production that's available, plus the new production in Africa and South America, we actually have more oil than we need. So prices should go below 60, maybe into the 50s and 40s. So if there truly is an absolute reopening of the strait, oil prices could drop pretty dramatically. Now, that would be great for American consumers, great for Ukraine versus Russia. If it's done without having to cede control of the strait to Iran, that would be a wonderful solution. But it's really hard to tell, because you'll get announcements where one announcement is the Iranians want to have negotiations. The president says we have negotiations scheduled in Qatar. And then the Iranians will say, nobody has talked to us. We're not negotiating with anybody. So it's for sure off again, on again, and we don't know what's happening. But I will say that the oil markets are speculating that this will come to an end.
Guy, I know we focus on oil, but what about all the other shipping? Obviously, shipping insurance rates. I mean, it seems that there's a ripple effect across the industry. What are we seeing there?
There is, and you have a bigger... There's a big challenge in fertilizer. There's not really a global shortage of oil. You know, the price may be unfortunately high in certain areas, but there's enough oil to go around. The fertilizer supplies are more constrained, and that's going to put pressure on farmers all over the world. That's one of the big things that passes through the strait. LNG going to Asia is another problem, and so that's something else that's a challenge. But the biggest things are the oil, fertilizer, and natural gas going through there.
Yeah, it's and when we think about, you know, the tail of this, let's say it gets resolved, I think Tuesday they're supposed to meet in Doha, allegedly, who knows. And, you know, we get to some, let's say, you know, that we hammer out an agreement. How does this all chill out, the tail of this?
The real problem with the agreement is we know from history that the Iranians are not the most forthcoming people in terms of their negotiating strategy and keeping their promises. You know, they promised President Obama they were not going to enrich uranium in exchange for his deal, and they broke the promise almost immediately. So when you make a deal with them, you have to have real enforcement mechanisms, or they're going to break the deal, because that's their history. The Revolutionary Guard has said that a nuclear weapon is something that they prioritize, they want to have. The president said they can never have nuclear weapons. We have the other bad example of North Korea, which we, you know, sort of pussyfooted around for years, and now they're a nuclear power and sort of no way to go back. The Iranians are looking at that and saying, you know, we've got a problem. Most of our citizens, if they could vote, would vote us out of office. We'd be thrown out, and we'd have a democracy in Iran. We need to maintain a monopoly on power. We need to keep the rest of the world nervous about us. So we need nuclear weapons in order to preserve our position. So it's hard for these guys who are, you know, basic thugs to want to give up any leverage, because they know they're not popular at home. They're certainly not popular around the world. And how this ends up remains to be seen. But we do have a precedent where we've made agreements with them, and they haven't honored any of the agreements. And, of course, the other thing that they would like to do is rearm all their proxies around, the Hezbollahs, Hamas, et cetera. So when they have extra money, that's one of the things they would like to use it on, is rearming the people that they have confronting Israel. And they, you know, when they say death to America, they're not kidding. They really have no good feelings toward us, no good feelings toward Israel. And if they could wipe Israel off the face of the map, they'd be very pleased. So it's tough to negotiate with folks like that.
Yeah. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, we'll talk about the World Cup and its economic impact and what factors cause countries to actually succeed in World Cup Cup soccer. We'll cover that and more when we return. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, I don't know about you, but I have thoroughly enjoyed watching World Cup soccer. I've enjoyed the little anecdotal stories of those traveling here and enjoying, I guess, the largesse of the United States of America.
Oh, absolutely. I've been watching the games. We're actually on vacation out of the country, and one of the ladies in our group is from Ghana, so we're watching Ghana get onto the next round. It was exciting. The U.S. moves on. What's been intriguing is as you watch other countries, I'm going to start with one. We just need to import Japanese fans to America to have them attend some Saints games. After the game, the Japanese, you know where this is going. The Japanese fans cleaned the stadium. And
exactly.
People ask, why are you doing this? I said, well, the stadium was clean when we arrived. It should be clean when we leave. So can we please get some Japanese fans to come to New Orleans, Smoothie King Center and the Superdome to clean up? There's been a lot of fun, too, with the foods. There was a meme going around Britain, a British couple back in Britain, and they're sitting at a restaurant, and the guy gets a hamburger and says, this would be a slider in the United States. And the lady is, where's our ranch dressing? He said, well, we can't make, come on, we're Britain. We have the technology. And then the guy's, how about a free refill? I said, not in England. There are no free refills. Well, it's bloody civilized in America. So,
yeah, I was reading a story about a couple that got lost in Costco. I was reading another story about another store that a grocery store that someone went to. They said they'd never seen a grocery store with so many different items and so many choices. They didn't know where to begin. I mean, it's hysterical when you think about the cultural differences between here and so many other countries.
Oh, yeah, and people are going on and on about Buc-ee's. It's like, this is a gas station. Can you believe it? And, you know, touring the aisles, things that we take for granted, a lot of great memes on Raising Cane's. Love the sauce, so good for Louisiana Company. Texas barbecue, cheese steaks. One Australian posted a video that's been watched thousands of times, said, if Popeyes came to Australia, they would own this country. Two pieces of crispy chicken, a biscuit, and coleslaw for only $6. This is phenomenal. How do they do it? Another one on Chick-fil-A. So, yeah, people have really been enjoying the American foods. And it's funny, you think Europeans are food snobs, but they're enjoying eating in America. And somebody even posted Golden Corral. All the desserts you want. Like, okay. So apparently things we take for granted are not that common in Europe.
You know what's going to be interesting is, and this happened to us, I think all of us, in Katrina when we went other places, right? And some folks had to live in other places and they came back and they got a taste of something else. Maybe something that was more efficient, the way that they operate something or whatever it may be. We changed or as a result of it because the expectations changed here. It will be interesting to see because it's rare that we have so many different people from so many different countries at the same time visiting our country, right? Especially around a sporting event, which brings a whole bunch of activities that they probably otherwise would not engage in just visiting here as a regular tourist. They go to, you know, all the little tourist places. But you're hearing so many people visiting bars, fast food operations, and the like. It will be interesting to see what happens. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think some of these things are going to go back. And like the guy in Australia, like call Popeyes, look, can I have a franchise? I want to serve this. I would be shocked if a year from now you can't get ranch dressing in London. One of the Brits said, you know, the bottomless cup of coffee, you know, one of the great innovations in America. It also goes the other way. The Scots are in Boston, and they actually changed the way Boston is operating. You know, Boston moved last call to 3 a.m. Boston also did not allow public drinking. You know, what we're so used to in New Orleans, a go cup where you go outside. They had to set up outdoor drinking areas. Boston also doesn't have happy hour. It's one of the few cities that doesn't allow that. And in the last hour before closing, Boston didn't have shots or pitchers available for sale. Well, with all the Scots in town, the breweries were literally running out of beer, having to restock, getting emergency shipments of kegs in. And so people in Boston are saying, you know, why can't it be like this all the time? Why can't we have outdoor drinking areas where people can socialize and walk around with something in their hand? You know, why can't we extend the hours? You know, why is it that we can't have discounted pricing? So I think some of this is going to be working the other way, where we're picking up things from the foreign guest. And like I said at the beginning, I'd love us to pick up after the Japanese and clean up a bit.
Yeah, let's pivot to the economic impact of this. As we see all these anecdotal stories, we see countries actually almost taking cities over. The impact's got to be huge, huh?
Yeah, what's happening is the impact is hitting specific industries and is very positive. The areas that have been impacted the most are Airbnb, rental accommodations, because people are traveling with families. So demand and pricing are both up. So if you have an Airbnb, a VRBO in any of the host cities, you've been able to fill it at a high rate. We've also seen the increase in sales at restaurants, because obviously people, you know, are arriving from out of town. They want to try local foods. They're not going in for fine dining. It's not a fine dining crowd. It's more of a sporting crowd. They're hitting the fast foods. They're hitting the chains. They're hitting the Buc-ee's, the Wawa's, which is a grocery store that we don't have here, but are very popular elsewhere. So grocery stores, bars, restaurants, as I said, some of the bars in Boston literally had to get emergency resupplies of beer because they were running out of beer because of the fans. So those numbers are up. The cities are also struggling on transportation. You know, we're not really a mass transit country the way Europe is. And so it's a little bit difficult to get around. So you're seeing a big increase in the surge pricing for the Uber and Lyft taxi cabs. New Jersey is taking a little bit of an advantage, I think. The normal fare to get out to the stadium is $13. They originally raised it to $150. And after many complaints, they reduced it to $98. Still very high, but that's going to be a windfall for New Jersey Transit. And they just said, well, we've got this opportunity. We're going to take advantage of it. You know, it's funny. Left-leaning cities often talk about greedy capitalists. Well, this is a left-leaning city and a union operation being fairly greedy for the visitors that don't have many options.
And meanwhile, the Japanese are cleaning our stadium.
Yeah.
I mean, you just, you know, oh, man, unbelievable. You kind of can't make this stuff up. But I think for the most part, overall positive. And congratulations to all the cities that have been able to host a World Cup soccer event. Guy, as always, we appreciate the time, the insight. Have a great 4th of July weekend.
Oh, you too. It's good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. And the U.S. team, I think, plays Wednesday night in the knockout round. So we look forward to being able to see them play Wednesday evening. And we wish them the best for sure. And just remember, when the storm hits and your power goes out, don't you want to feel confident that your home and family will be okay? Don't get caught in the heat and dark this summer. Win backup power from WWL and Craig's Electrical and Generator Service. We're giving away a Generac GP6500 portable generator. Nearly $1,000 value right now. Enter at WWL.com/contests. And you can win a peace of mind from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service. And when the power goes off, Craig comes on with WWL. And don't forget that WWL and the Riverfront Marketing Group invite you to go forth on the river. Join them for a historic Independence Day celebration along New Orleans Riverfront with a world-class free fireworks display this Saturday, July 4th, 9 p.m. So make sure you get out there early to enjoy the pleasures of the French Quarter and downtown New Orleans hotels, museum, restaurants, bars, and grab a great viewing spot from either bank, including the brand-new Gold Ring Waldenburg Riverfront Park. Be there when we light up the skies and celebrate America's 250th birthday. So go forth on the river from the Riverfront Marketing Group, WWL, and our sister station, Magic 101.9. Scoot's headed your way. It's a manic Monday. The state of Texas will become the first state to require public school students to read selections from the Bible.
It's Sophia with an F, Franklin with the Y, and if you're looking for some bubblegum dum-dum podcast, then you are in the wrong place, baby. Whether I'm reminiscing on the trials and tribulations of working in the corporate world to recapping today's latest reality TV show, you're going to want to pull up a chair and stick around. It's a good time and always 100% unfiltered. Follow and listen to Sophia with an F wherever you get your podcasts.